Good evening and welcome to another episode of Grains of Wisdom, an online webinar in which we have insightful conversations and all things to do with Irish whiskey with our master distiller here at Parscourt Distillery, Mr. Noel Sweeney. We're delighted this evening to be joined by Fionnán O'Connor. Fionnán O'Connor is an independent Irish whiskey writer living in Dublin, and his Glass Apart book was published in October 2015 and hailed by the Irish Times as the definitive guide to Irish single pot still whiskey. He has served as a consultant and lecturer for distilleries across Ireland, representing Irish whiskey on boards of several global spirits education programmes, and in 2018 he was awarded a full-time PhD grant by the Irish Research Council to investigate the potential of lost mash bills in driving innovation in contemporary Irish distilling. At the 2020 Icons of Whiskey Award, he was the first recipient of the Irish Whiskey Communicator of the Year Award, and he continues to contribute articles and books to magazines across the trade. Fionnán, you're very welcome, and thank you for joining us this evening.
No problem. I don't know if I can live it up to that, but glad to
And of course, our master distiller here at Parscourt Distillery, Noel Sweeney, needs no introduction at this stage. I'm merely here just to introduce you both this evening, as we will be continuing the same form and vein as our chat a few weeks ago with Dave Broome. So you guys have much to discuss, so I'll throw the conversation over to you guys, and then if any questions come in, I'll put them to you at the end. Okay.
Good evening, Fionnán. Thanks very much, Caroline. That was a very, very nice introduction, and fully explains everything there is to know about, Fionnán's background and where he's coming from. And it's great to talk to you, Fionnán, and I'm starting off with a little dram of the 18-year-old Fir Cullen, because I think tonight we're going to have a look at the new, not so new as it is, and to go back over some of the early history of Irish whiskey.
Brilliant. Well, I'm here with a glass of Jameson Black, Fir Cullen. Good to see you.
Yeah, that's good. And what do you think of this kind of whiskey now? I mean, are you into tasting whiskeys a lot?
Now and again, when there's really no other option. It's funny. I remember, I know the 18 is kind of the up until now of your own career, because it's brought over from your previous distilling. But I haven't seen this. I don't know, for me, it brought me back 5 years. I remember, actually a little bit more than 5 years, right when Tyrconnell started having the 17, 18-year-olds, I think 17 and a half, there was a Hungarian whiskey enthusiast who pulled me aside one night and poured the oldest Tyrconnell I think I'd had. And I haven't had that flavor since. And I remember pouring this for the first time, and it actually, it was like the memory, the Proustian moment, but it just took me back to what you had been doing years ago that seemed to kind of belong to that year more than to this.
Well, exactly. This is stuff that I made while I was in Cooley, and signed by it. But again, it's gone on a couple of years since then, and I think it's all the better for it. But I guess what we're here tonight to talk about is kind of the current whiskey as we have here, and then to look back at something that's starting off. And tonight we have a sample of our 2-year-old malt, and I just wanted to have your opinion as well as to what you think about that as a whiskey. And I mean, it is quite young, and I have a wee taste of it here, and I thought it will be 2 years in cask on the, I think it's the 18th of August, so almost 2 years. So what's a couple of months among friends, as they say? But we started and distilling in June, so this is our anniversary, our second distilling anniversary. So another year down the road, and this stuff will be called whiskey. But as it stands, it's quite enjoyable.
The I have the 2-year-old here, I think. And yeah, I didn't know what to expect. I been meaning to get down there for probably a year and 9 months myself at this point.
Yes, indeed.
I had expected, I thought, well, will it taste like the malt you made before? You know, when I think of Cooley, I think of pears, cut grass, a very specific kind of whiskey. And of course, this is triple distilled rather than double distilled, and obviously any number of variables. But it's, can I pour the new make first just to compare?
Of course, absolutely.
Yeah. Because I have a lot to say about this whiskey, but it begins with, because I had them both delivered, and thanks very much to your man for dropping them off. But the new make spirit, because I remember going up to, I think the first time I met you was when I was in the early research for A Glass Apart, and there were two fringe things that Cooley had done that weren't part of, you know, the main range, and I went up just to find those and ended up spending the evening drinking the main range and talking about it.
And, as you do when you get into the distillery.
Very closer than I'll admit to making it a broader subject for the book. But when I was up there, I remember tasting Cooley New Make. And I remember, you know, at that time, I think Irish malt whiskey is going to be a lot more difficult to get your head around very soon. Because back, I mean, that was only 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And there were really two malts. There was Bushmills and there was Cooley. And under various guises, you know, a lot of people, myself included, got away with a parlor trick of knowing your Bushmills from your Cooleys. But we're all, you know, we're all going to be shown for the crooks we are as soon as all these new malts come out. And so, you know, I wasn't sure what to expect, but it doesn't smell like Cooley. It doesn't smell a bit like Cooley. I was thinking, well, this is still Noel. It'll, you know, it'll probably have a lot of family resemblance. For me, it's almost like if Cooley, now obviously Cooley as it matures, I mean, Cooley has that wonderful kind of sweet young spot around 7 to 9 where it's just, you've mown the lawn, it's cut grass, lemon rind, pear. And so I tend to think of Cooley of all shapes and sizes as that, which is obviously the wrong way to go about it. But even working backward from that, what I loved about this, when I gave it a preview nip before we logged on, it has, yeah, it has grassiness, sure. It even has a kind of a pear, but it's not, you know, when I think of, say, like the Bushmills triple distilled spirit, it's pineapple-y, it's sharp, it's very, you know, you could cut glass with it. And here, it is like a triple distilled grassiness, that pear, that grass, it's been brought to a slightly lighter. It's almost like, you know, if you could turn those flavors into kind of lemon drizzle, you know, it's more like someone's baked it for a bit. It reminds me of pound cake a lot. You know, that strange, I don't know, we talk about vanilla off of bourbon barrels, but there's always that kind of new make vanilla. And I've never come up with the way to describe them, but you know that, it's almost like a frosting smell. You know, it's a very icing type smell. And what I loved about this was it had that in spades, and the pear and the fruits. And the result is, yeah, like,
it's very drinkable on its own, right? And I think that was what we were aiming for in its production, you know, that, and being triple distilled, you know, a couple of people have said to me, you know, it's quite generous with copper. So the copper will, you know, really help in as it matures, and we'll see later on and further on into the maturation of it. But as a young spirit, everybody that has tried it has said, yeah, really easy to drink, and will have a potential without a doubt. And I'm very excited. I'm glad in a lot of ways. You know, obviously when you start up a new distillery, it's never going to be exactly the same. It's, you know, people are saying, is this going to be another Tyrconnell? Well, I don't think that we should aim for that as such, but it is, I suppose, it is, and it's going to be fun to see how it turns out in another few years.
Yeah. You know what it tastes like to me? And I finally got it. Do you know the name of those? We used to get peaches that were flat. They were kind of donut shaped, white peaches. And there's always, it's almost like they taste like old white peach, even when they're young. There's that strange, it's fruit, but there's a certain kind of fattiness to it. There's a certain kind of, you know, almost like apricot, that kind of thing, where they're very plush. It doesn't feel like sharp fruit. It doesn't even feel as sweet as some fruit. It feels fatty. It feels plush. It feels like apricot and white peach had this weird vanilla love child together. I can't wait to see what happens. Well, I did see, because again, I nipped the other one too.
yeah, we have to chew you all there.
Bourbon Barrel, but
yeah,
it is, again, the only reference we have really for aged triple distilled malt is really Bushmills. Mm-hmm. And Bushmills is such a distinctive, you know, I think mango and pineapple, and the spirit is so sharp, so direct, you know.
So you think Bushmills is safe from Ferrucullen?
I think they're more different than expected.
Exactly.
I think that's going to be the thing
that's about all of these new distilleries that are opening up. They're all going to have their own character, and that is going to be developed, you know, from processing and all the rest of it that goes into the production and distilling of it.
So, I mean, what strength, if you don't mind me ask, is this coming off at when it comes off the still, say?
It's typically around 76.
Okay, so it's quite low for a triple distilled.
Yes,
Might explain why it's because it feels like a light double distilled malt almost. You know, it's got that, it's retained. Yes.
Fattier.
Yeah, again, where mm-hmm. Bushmills, and even I've only had one nip of Auchentoshan when it was spirited, and again, that much, a lot, it becomes much, much sharper, mm-hmm. focused in a sense, but again, a very, very, very light spirit. Whereas here, yeah, there is this weird, like, again, apricot, white, peach, almost, how would you put it? Almost a mustiness in the fruit, which I don't associate with new make at all, but there's a kind of a, you know, the peaches with the skin left on, mm-hmm. the kind of, not just the sweetness, but
I mean, I think it's got great potential anyway. And I'm sure, as we say, we can only surmise as to what this is going to turn out like. And but the characteristics there are all positive, you know, and that's the main thing when you're distilling a spirit that you have to look out for.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just getting the words for it now, that finish. It's like pound cake. There's a weird vanilla, but it's a baker's vanilla. It's that kind of, you know, risen pastry, again, like drizzle, you know, things that, not just the frosting, but the like paley pastry underneath, and it works really well. So again, I'm eagerly anticipating, especially a bourbon barrel, you know, what you think those creams are due to it.
We should move on to the two-year-old and see what that is like at this stage. And I think that this particular sample of two-year-old is quite, you talk about drizzle or whatever. This one reminds me of lemon drizzle. And again, it's certainly not what you have described earlier as like the coolie style, but it's not dissimilar either in a lot of ways, because you can pick up the sweetness and the lemon and the bit of vanilla sweetness that you'll always get there, citruses and that kind of thing. And a little touch of oak coming into it as well.
Yeah. I mean, again, lemon's a hot word for me in Cooley. You know, anytime I have mm-hmm. anything that smells like lemon and is young, I remember Cooley. So it is there. And again, it doesn't lose that peachiness, that strange white peach and apricot, that, you know, plushness. It's light, but it's, again, light, but heavy, if that makes sense. It's light, but it's puffy. It's got, you know,
there's viscosity to it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a, as you say, the flavor might be a little delicate or mm. light, but it's still there in spades.
It'll hold its own as it ages.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have no idea what it'd do in sherry or anything else. It seems so naturally coupled to honey and vanilla. And you know what it smells like? Coconut butter. Now, I didn't know what coconut butter was for years. Yeah. And I assumed it smelled really sweet, like coconut stuff. And then I finally got it and I thought, this is very pasty, very dry. But it reminds me of that strange waxiness. You know, it's got coconut probably from the bourbon barrel, that strange coconut, but wax, you know, it doesn't feel tropical. It's not the kind of put a lime in the coconut or whatever. It still has that, again, the skin's left on, that strange mustiness. Light as a feather still. And uncustard, as I say, lemon drizzle. You know, that vanilla, that baked vanilla is getting the honey. And what, that's 1 year, 9 months?
Yeah. And I mean, we do have some new making in sherry and in in casks. Not as long as that now, but I mean, the whiskey will certainly develop much better with the sherry cask, that's for sure. But I think initially we, like a lot of people, would put it into bourbon for a minimum of 5 or 6 years anyway, and then try and develop that flavor in an older whiskey. So that's very promising.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, geez, that'll be the malt to watch. I don't say that lightly. Certainly, triple distilled unpeated malt, there's a lot to look up to, you know.
Absolutely.
Quite a high standard. And there was never, I know the pot still run you guys did it too, Cooley, at the end was triple distilled. Did you ever do triple distilled malt at Cooley?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Not an awful lot of it, but we did, yes. We try everything as possible and try to diversify as much as we could. And that was more or less later on when initially, I guess in Cooley, the idea was, well, you know, as the story goes, everything Irish was supposed to be triple distilled. So we were kind of bucking the trend on that one. And it was kind of like going to do a triple distillation is like saying, well, okay, maybe it's not that bad. But you know, it has its merits as well, and those kind of things have to should be exploited. So I think there's absolutely every. I mean, we have, this is a triple distilled malt, but we also have triple distilled or double distilled malt that we've done in Power Sport as well. So maybe we get you to have a look at that at some time in the future.
Yeah, and how are you finding it? Did you find the double distilled?
It's
wildly different.
It's got a little bit more weight to it, as we say, you know, but it all depends, you know. It's going to take time to see what happens in the wood and that, you know, but interesting times ahead, and going to be nice whiskies out of some of this. The other one we have there, of course, is the new make pot still. I'm just dying to hear what you have to say about our pot still. And don't forget to add a drop of water to it, because it is
75.9, a generous
yeah,
pot still coming off the still at roughly the same
76 ish.
Okay. I have a reticent to say goodbye to that malt.
We had David Broom tasting some of our new make the last time he was on. He was quite chuffed with it as well. So it's always nice to get someone's a few different opinions on these things, you know.
No, absolutely. And even to see people triple distilling and cutting that low, you know, sometimes the triple distillate can go further in purity. Absolutely. But well, I remember when I first came up, I mean, one of my favorite new makes of all time anywhere was what was sold as the Cooley Putchin, the single pot still project that seems to have disappeared since. But I mean, I know it only saw the light of day as new make, but it was like, yes, something between pot still and grappa. You know, it had that. I'd never tasted that in pot still before, that almost kind of grapiness.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think that was bottled at 50% alcohol as well.
Yeah, it was healthy enough.
Yes, no, absolutely. But I mean, Putchin is regarded like as the, you know, you can get it any which way you like sometimes. And but it is a raw spirit, and therefore it has to be looked at in that light, you know. But when we were doing it in Cooley, we decided, you know, that it had to be a drinkable product. That's the first thing. I mean, some of the new makes can have a lot of faints in them and you know, as people say, very young spirit. And it's very detectable in that respect. So, but when you're making a spirit that you're expecting to drink straight away, or at least very young, you kind of tighten the heart a little bit to make sure you don't overdo it with the faints.
Of course. I mean, that was quite a, yeah, I mean, it's been a long time. You can't find stuff anymore. But I remember being struck by how sharp it was in a good way, you know, the kind of fruitier end of pot still. And that was 50-50. This is 50% malt, 50 raw barley as well, or is this?
No, the Putchin you're talking about in Kilbeggan or?
In Cooley, the one that was done in River.
No, that was 50% alcohol. It was a pure malt distillate, as far as I can remember.
Are you sure? Because that was...
Otherwise, we did a pot still. Did we do a pot still Putchin? I can't remember. Is that
what you're talking
about? Yeah.
The there was the one done in Kilbeggan, and then you had done one in Riverston as well. And I think I put both of them in separately, and I'm not sure what the stocks matured into, but I remembered it was the Riverston.
Yeah, we did. We just did the one bottling, I think, of a pot still, poaching. So memory loses me now at the minute whether it was pot still or malt.
But it said single pot still on the label.
Yeah, well, then it was pot still.
I think, you know who still has it is Dave Mulligan.
I have a bottle here somewhere.
Yes. Of course, you have. What am I saying? But I loved that stuff, the kind of, great.
Well, very, very nice indeed. And pot still in Cooley, we had different mash bills at the time, doing a little bit of experimentation. But I think it was somewhere around the 30 to 50 concentration of barley. But it was very challenging to produce in the kit that we had in Cooley. But even when we distilled pot still down in Kilbeggan with rye and that, the mash bill now didn't actually comply with that technical file type of thing that eventually came currently. But anyway, I mean, that's all history. We're looking at what's current, and as I say, the pot still that we have in Powerscourt is a 30% barley and 70% malt concentration.
Okay, so yeah, pushing, I mean, that's quite unusual. You know, people either do the Middleton mash or 50-50. So it's great to see, even within malt and barley, somebody playing the other way, you know, playing on the offensive rather than the defensive side of field.
Yeah.
You know what it's like? If somebody took the malt and produced a boot polish out of it and scrubbed, I mean, this is totally as a compliment, and I haven't had this one before, and I was saving this one, but it's that same musty white peach, but it just becomes thicker and more, you know, again, oily. It's not terribly oily in comparison to some of the heavy raw barley pot stills, but it's obviously oilier than the malt. But again, everything becomes stewed fruit. What might have been, you know, white fruit is slightly more stewed, slightly, I don't know. I mean, the politest term would be leathery, but I prefer boot polish because I think it's closer to what I like about it. It's that strange, I don't know. A lot of good pot still spirit, I think, tastes more leathery than malt. I think malt hits the sweet notes so well, and pot still plays with a different vocabulary. And I think that's why, you know, pot still.
And what about the spiciness of it?
It has, yeah, it's that strange. I mean, again, you don't want to compare to the older stuff, but you look at the likes of, say, like John's Lane or some of the younger Middletons are more kind of oil forward. They have that weird boot polish, you know, leatheriness about them. And this, I've never had a spirit that quite had it that pronounced. I've had some pot stills coming out are very, very, very oily, and some are very, very, very barley tasting, and some taste like Middleton or in that range. But I've never had something that was this kind of peachy and still sporting that again, kind of lip coating or mouth coating leatheriness, you know. Let me try with a bit more water in there.
Has that changed it now for you?
Oh my God. Yeah, we brought to a modest, you know, 69% or something. And it's strange, maybe it's because I'm having it back to back with malt, but every instinct wants to compare it back there. But they are starkly different to each other. But it is fruitier, and I suppose that's partly to do with the higher malt content. Fruitier than a lot of pot still distillate, but you wouldn't mistake it for malt any day soon. It still has that, again, that base cleft from birth, pot still weight. It still has, it's almost like, I said grapes for the old one, and I mean, that was so long ago. These might be false nostalgic memories at this point. But this, it doesn't taste like grappa, but it does taste weirdly like, you know, like white grapes. You know, that's strange. If it is a grapiness, it's a pale, you know, there's something.
It's not like gooseberries, no?
Gooseberry. Yeah, there we go. Not enough gooseberries in my life, you know.
You should drink more Sauve Blanc.
I keep a humble shelf of, you know, apples and pears, and
yeah,
rare that I get the odd gooseberry in the shopping basket. But yeah, that's exactly it. And I remember interviewing Barry, mm-hmm, when I was doing the book research just before he retired, and he was talking about some of the cork pot still before IDL, and you know what the cork distillers had been doing. And he said, you know, they made a fruitier style of pot still. Everyone goes on about Dublin, and you know, again, the big oils and big, you know, again, like
meaty.
Yeah. And it wasn't until I finally got a shot at some young cork, none of the really old, you know, Dungourney, however many years in oak, but just a Paddy 7 from the 60s. And there was that weird, again, like gooseberry, you know, there's a kind of a fruit that you get with the ginger, you know, and it works really, really well. Mm-hmm. And again, maybe it's just false memory here, but.
Oh, well, I'll take that.
It reminds me of that, you know, again, it's like honeydew melon. If honeydew melon had ginger and grit and could kind of bite back instead of, you know, caving and turning into water, it has that weird, you know, you said Sauvignon Blanc, it has that, I mean, again, like it's only kind of certain white wines do that mm-hmm, strange, so fresh and so melony and yet so crackly, so spry, you know.
Excellent. So one of the reasons, Fionn, that we were looking at all of these again is to kind of go back and look at some of the history of the development of Irish whiskey. I mean, we've seen a couple of examples here of new make and older whiskey as well. But back in the day, I mean, and this is what your research has done to some extent, is highlighted some of the earlier productions of whiskey. So how have you seen from your research, like how has the Irish whiskey scene changed or even developed initially?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long history. So, I mean, the stuff I'm doing for the PhD is specifically 1779 to 1975. So it's it's the Lord North Act up to the final consolidation of everything into a monopoly with it, you know, a central plant rather than, of course, Bushmills. And how did things evolve within that space? Old history is something I do for fun, and there's a little prelude in there. And so it depends when we want to talk, you know. Old whiskey history is again, all kinds of weird and strange, and half of it isn't really whiskey at all. And sure, I think that's something people forget when we tell the history of Irish whiskey, is we tend to tell a kind of a story of divine creation rather than evolution. You know, it's whiskey from the 1600s looked absolutely nothing like even the new make here. You know, whiskey is the result of its history, not mm-hmm, the source of its history.
And I always say to people, you know, that initially, how did whiskey develop into actually being whiskey as well? You know, I mean, people learned how to distill spirit, and they learned from whatever raw materials they would have had around at the time, and be that wheat or barley or oats or rye, discovered better ways of producing more spirit and better quality spirit. And once they had this, what we call the eau de vie, I suppose, the only way of storing it was in wooden barrels. And again, it was obviously after a certain amount of trial and error with different types of wood, the oak casks held it better and for longer. And then sherry and port, which was very much the drink of the gentry, were plenty of barrels floating around the country, were filled with this raw spirit. And this is where whiskey developed from. And eventually we in the distillery industry, since about, I suppose, goodness, since bourbon took off, have taken up the use of the bourbon barrel more so than would have been historically there. But is that a kind of a simplified version of the history of the product?
I mean, and there on the screen are a few photos of old abandoned distilleries. Uwe took those for the book. All the images are his. did a fantastic job. But there's a number of those out there. Just so I think that's Burr, Burt, and Monasterevin. And a lot of it, you know, it's amazing to me looking about how much of that industrial history is just sitting there.
Yeah. I mean, you could go to Nuns Island in Galway. I mean, you know, they placed on in Dundalk here. So there's a distillery. Now it's a library and a museum in Dundalk. And that was a big distillery at the time, as were most of the little ones dotted around the coast. And you know, they've been dotted all over the place. And I think that it was Bernard's book that tells people where they were then, you know.
But I mean, and to touch on your earlier point, I mean, long before Alfie went on his kind of jolly around the country. When we talk about barrels, I mean, one thing that always struck me is, you know, what are the legal definitions of whiskey today? It has to be distilled from grain. It has to be aged in barrels, and it can't have anything added to it. None of those apply to the original whiskey, you know. So where does Ishka Baha stop and whiskey begin? Where does medicine stop and where does, you know, spirit begin? And that was something that really fascinated me. You know, my original background was in medieval lit, and looking at how words get used, because if you see the term aqua vita, you know, usually we look for just the first reference to distilling, but the Red Book of Ossory here is not really about whiskey at all. It's about medicinal distilling. And medicinal distilling gives way to popular distilling, and popular distilling gives way to professional distilling, and professional distilling gives way to industrial distilling. And all of this kind of bleeds in through, you know, it's a very muddy water connecting all of them together. So I think too often we get very comfortable about telling the story of whiskey, but there's a lot of dead ends and there's a lot of overlap.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I mean, everybody would know and agree that the whiskey production started off as a small backyard or monasteries making stuff and going on and developing that, and eventually coming to where you try to regularize or standardize. And I think that's a double-edged sword in a lot of ways, because when you look at standardization, then you kind of tying down what you can and cannot do. And in some ways that can be very restrictive. And that's where we're kind of at in this current stage with GI and technical files. When Cooley started making Irish whiskey, the definition of Irish whiskey was extremely loose. I mean, the 1980 Act of Irish government on Irish whiskey had about four lines that were relevant, you know, insofar as it had to be distilled and matured on the island of Ireland, had to be made from a mash of cereals with or without the addition of natural enzymes, and it has to be distilled less than 94.8% alcohol, and had to retain the flavour of the raw materials that were there. That was it. After that, there was no real legislation, except that the revenue used to control the production, and you had to, you know, you couldn't distill without a revenue officer. So, I mean, the history of Irish and of spirits and Irish whiskey is also peppered with the interference of government, in taxes.
Absolutely. But look, I mean, and again, a lot of what I would do with the academic hand is bone dry legislative history, but also the relationship between that and the course that whiskey took. So, for instance, I mean, the first references to popular grain distilling, to really what became whiskey, are all government interventions, usually about wheat and cash crops and food crops. And, you know, the first two big grain references to in Irish distilling are both about barring the use of wheat. Because again, the idea is that this is useful for white bread. Wheat, of course, was a luxury crop and it was rare, but it was also used specifically for the bread of the better off. And as you progress, I mean, you find all kinds of legislations. You think, well, you know, of course you would do this, but they would curb the way that whiskey went. Like, for instance, when the excise is set up, it takes another, say, 40 years before the government start intervening in low wines. And it's largely to do with trying to keep the distillers in check and make sure that every part is accounted for. But they start saying, for the purposes of just ease of taxing, they say you can't distill sugar and cereals at the same time, whiskey can only be that because we tax them separately. So before then, you get muddy concoctions of people running sugar and grain together. That goes out the window, or, you know, and all of these things that we just assume to be part of the natural course of whiskey are actually the muddled results of pragmatism, business, agriculture, government intervention, any number of forces that get in the way or that alter or redirect the personal choices of any distiller who happens to be working at the time.
And of course, the odd chance here and there, you know, I mean, yeah. And discovery and experimentation and all the rest of it. And it all leads to where we are, I guess, today as well. You know, I mean, that is what's intriguing, I think, about making a product like this, that there is such a history behind it that people go back and say, well, even the milling techniques of the past, I mean, if you visit Kilbeggan, you'll see the old stone mill there, a big circular stone powered by the water wheel. You know, I mean, it's fascinating to see these things. And yet nowadays we've got these concise roller mills, hammer mills, wet mills, blah, blah, blah. You know, the technologies have changed, improving in a lot of ways the techniques and standardizing, you know, even the malt production nowadays is so controlled that, you know, the what pesticides you can use. And this is all very positive in a lot of ways. There's the mill there on the bottom left in Kilbeggan and in the black and white photograph. That's still there, those big stones. The malt or barley used to go into the middle of that stone and come out through another, that big stone is actually spinning underneath, and the grain is separated out from the middle into a collection vessel and goes down into a bag, and then it's hauled over to the mash tun. But, you know, and it's fascinating to look at the way things were done then and how they're done now, where it's all confined and enclosed. When you go to a new distillery, more modern distillery, everything is hygiene and all the rest of it, you know, and rightly so. But what I'm going to get to is all of these things affect the history and affect where we are, what we are doing nowadays as distillers compared to how difficult times were back then. And even the use of peat, we looking at that was more prevalent years and years ago, when, you know, especially when they didn't have any other kind of fuel to dry the barley or the malt, they had nothing else to use on the peat. And it was, as John Teeling said on the last chat show we had, it was the people at ports that were importing coal from the UK when coal became widespread, they used coal instead of peat. Because it was more efficient and more easier to use, and then, you know, that developed the non-peated whiskies in Ireland.
Yeah, well, I know we were talking about this recently for something else, but I think you got that record I sent on to you. You know, you have the parliamentary meeting in 1841, I think it is 1844, and they come out and say all Irish single malts. Well, they weren't using the term single malts, but they said all the malt whiskey is peated, and this allows you to compete with Poitchin, whereas the Dublin distilleries, their stuff is not peated, and that won't drive Poitchin out of the market. And you're like, well, geez, there it is in writing, Irish single malts universally peated. And it's fascinating, you know, again, a lot of, you know, of course, historically in the 1800s, malt whiskey was
you do appreciate, you know, that the Irish always maintain we showed the Scotch how to make it anyway. So it's obvious it had to be treated in Ireland before they went to Scotland. But again, exactly. I mean, it was things that went into fashion and out of fashion for whatever reason. And again, down to taxes. There was even that debate was on about the tax on fuel in some cases as to how it was easier to use one fuel than another to make the whiskey. And you got, you know, even in today's terms, you know, you look at what they try to do in governments to move people away from fossil fuels now to other types of energy. You know, it's the same idea.
I mean, even Austin Boyd in the 60s was talking about Bushmills as peated. He said he looks for a slight peaty taste, you know. Yeah. And it was when their maltings closed down and again, they start sourcing it from other places and eventually they become part of IDL. And this vanishes from the history. you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, of course, it was there from the start, really. You know, as soon as you're making malt, you use what fuel is around you, you know. Mm-hmm.
So it's not unusual then to come up with a peated whiskey in Ireland, I think, you know. And even though it was a groundbreaking thing in Ireland, and it's amazing how it's the people that kind of win the war, as it were, or survive whatever contraction there was in the Irish whiskey industry that set the tone. And I think that's generally what happens, you know. It's the person that wins the war writes the history, because everybody else was. But thankfully, in this kind of an environment, we still have those old records, and this is another aspect of the modern time that we're in, where we're now in recent years, only in the last couple of years, actually. Identified some of the legislation now around making Irish whiskey, and you have this technical file, which again is one of these constraints that tells you this is the only way you can make Irish whiskey, if you want to call it Irish whiskey, and there are views out there that this is not maybe the only story in town, and I think that's something that has to be aired and will be aired over the next number of years.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's one thing because again, that particular debate hits home for me very closely, because obviously my thesis is on the history of Irish mash bills, so this, you know, it is the same history, and I think there's a lot of mystery out there, a lot of obfuscation about what was done when. A lot of people don't seem to know, and I think the best thing to do is to make sure the information is out there as openly as possible, so that everybody's at least on the same page. You know, there's a lot. I think there was a document raised in the images back there, the Irish Potstill Distillers Association, and that was probably the single most important to what I'm doing document that came up, and it was misshelved, as it were. Do we see it there? No. Earlier than that, it should look like old. There we go. That was in a folder. Of course, all the locks stuff belongs to the National Library. I actually found the old Tyrconnell mash bill. Too little, too late. But
we'll talk about that some other time.
funnily enough, closer to what's now being sold as Kilbeggan Potstill. Relatively very close. But the old Waterside Distillery in Derry. But this particular file cropped up in the locks records. They're in the manuscripts reading room. And there was one box in particular that were locks copies of the Irish Potstill Distillers Association internal records. Every member, there were five members. There was B. Daly, there was Locks, and then Cork Distillers, Jemison and Powers. They didn't have to deal with Cumbrian Bushmills at that point because they were north of the border. But all five are members, and all five would have gotten copies of everything sent out to them. And everything is postmarked from Bow Street and signed off and so forth. And that document for me is important for a number of reasons. One, it's just a few years before B. Daly and Locks both went to Wall and ceased to exist, and then the remaining three eventually amalgamated into one company. So if you're to talk about, say, the IWA now, the last time there was something like that, there was industry cooperation without being industry amalgamation, that would have been the IPDA. And of course, before the 80s Act, which said very little, there was the 50s Act, the 1951 Act, which said even less about what whiskey should be. And this particular document was an attempt to redress the lack of detail in the 1951 document. And what struck me was that bit at the bottom where it says, you know, the materials used in the production of the whiskey are barley, oats, wheat, yeast, and water. And these are the processes used. And they say, you know, 80% barley, 15% oats, 5% wheat, and about 40-40 split between the barley and the malt. And I think there's a lot of belief out there that the mashes were wildly different, whereas actually they were quite similar. And that's the kind of disappointing part of the thesis, is that there were very clearly trade practices. And by the 50s, you know, I went through the Locke's records, but they were all doing roughly within spitting distance similar things. There was more malt and more oats coming out of Dublin. The Ulster distilleries tended not to use wheat and rye. Rye was very small, but it's almost like bourbon now, where there's, you know, high rye bourbon, there's normal bourbon, and there's wheated bourbon. They were very specific, you know, A, B, and C. They weren't flying all over the place. And of course, the stuff laid down in 1953, I mean, all Locke's and all B. Daly is, you know, roughly along that split. And any Bow Street, Powers and CDC that was laid down then would be that in the 60s, because of course that's when it matures. So that was a huge shock to me to slowly, and that was only one document, but to slowly piece together this story about trade practices from certain eras, about how there had been you could sign a document with all five members saying, this is what we do. And yeah, they're not quite the same, but they do, you know, match similar strains. And I think it's important to demystify, you know, what was done, as well as to be open and honest about it, you know, because that is so much of that was lost through the ambiguity of the acts themselves. You know, nobody knew. And then they were all going to switch to blends in 1967 anyway.
I think it's also very important to realize that, you know, a lot of distillers made these choices because of economic realities. Malt is much more expensive than barley to use, and there was a perception that oats was better to use in the mash tun, so you got a better filtration. And there were reasons for these other than flavor. And
well, nobody's doing this for their health, you know.
it is a business after all. That
yeah, and these. I mean, one of the things that would crop up, I was always wondering when wheat disappeared. You know, rye was the smallest by far, and it disappeared first, and then wheat, and then oats was the last to go. And wheat disappears around the 50s, again shortly after that. And during the 40s you have the emergency years rationing, and when I was looking through the Locke's records, they start having to ask for, you know, certificates from the Dublin, from the Board of Agriculture to get wheat. This all becomes very, very difficult to source. And then surprise, surprise, it disappears. You know, these strange accidents of agricultural history, financial history, pragmatic, you know, and I don't think any of that detracts from it. You know, raw barley came in for very economic reasons, but I don't think anyone's going to detract from its role in the course of Irish distilling history. To this day, the big mystery for me is rye, because rye was actually very small in Irish pot still's history. We've been growing rye since the Middle Ages as a seemingly a regenerative crop, but there's no history of rye brewing to speak of. There's no real history of rye bread in comparison to Central Europe. And it comes into Irish column stills when it comes in, but from about the 1870s onwards, the Irish pot still distillers start adding about 3-5% rye, and sometimes as low as 1%. And I've to this day never cracked why anyone would bother at that low percentage. You know, oats tended to be about 15-25%, wheat about 5-15%, and then rye very, very slim for most people.
Exactly. Yeah,
there must be a reason. So there's a lot of stuff still out there to work out.
And nowadays, I mean, a lot of and you mentioned their column stills. I mean, in Ireland, you know, I mean, initially the no-go Bay Area of Irish distillers, and yet it was the likes of Andrew A. Watt that you know really flourished with the column still distilling of grain. And nowadays, it's a huge part of what we do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, by the turn of the century, by 1900, there was more column still whiskey coming out of Ireland than there was pot still. You know, and people often forget this. In terms of sheer volume, there was Ulster had an enormous column still boom. And what was striking me was, you know, for all the fuss about old Irish pot still mash bills, There's a lot of Irish cognomstile mash bills that have been entirely forgotten. Again, like weird combinations of rye and oats and, you know, of course, maize is the big boogeyman coming in after the 1850s that the Irish pot distillers wanted kept out, you know. And it's all agricultural history, of course. You know, you get the corn laws, the tariffs on imported grain, and they get repealed because of the famine, and then suddenly you get heaps of American maize coming into Ireland at the exact same time that you get cognomstiles that are equipped to plow through it. And so, you know, the cognomstile boom was built on US maize coming in, and funnily enough, US rye as well, even though there was a small amount of Irish rye. So they're all mutants of history.
And is there any history of the old humble potato in the production of whiskey? We know it was used extensively.
Yeah, almost. You know, it's funny. Very, very little. And you know, one of the recurrent myths about poaching is that poaching was ever in any sort of critical mass made from potatoes. And I think E.B. Maguire put that squarely to bed. That, you know, before the 20th century, there's essentially nothing, and afterwards, there's only hearsay. You know, because of course, you don't distill vital crops. You don't distill what you need to eat. You distill what you have surplus of, or what you can do without.
Economic reality of life.
Yeah, and not to mention, of course, you know, to get fermentable. I mean, there is obviously fermentable starch in potatoes, but usually you need to kickstart it with malt as well, anyway.
Of course.
You know, so there isn't really. I mean, poaching. You know, original poaching. Let's say like 1779 to the famine is malt new make, really, you know, most of the time. Peated malt new make, sometimes malted oats as well as malted barley, but all dried over turf. In a happier, brighter world, Donegal would have become the Irish Islay. You know, every record says it's very smoky and it's made of malt. And what happened in Scotland was you had the Small Stills Act, where the government basically got tired of chasing them and said, look, if your still is small enough, you don't have to pay nearly as much tax. And that should have happened in Ireland to encourage small distilleries. But in fact, we went the other way and we gave breaks to the larger distilleries.
The bigger distilleries, the easier, the cheaper it was to produce them.
Yeah, and it was easier to control, because if you're dealing with big numbers, it's harder to lie to the tax man. And I think that really set the course for a lot of the flavor differences that emerged between prevailing Irish and prevailing Scotch practice, was the dominance in Ireland of urban distilling and market towns, you know, canal towns and so forth, to the exclusion of very, very small operations, the kind of choking out. In one sense, it kept quality of a certain kind very focused, but at the same time, it weeded out what poaching might have become. And then it's almost as the Parliament whiskey gets better, the poaching gets worse, where after the famine, poaching goes from being a serious competitor to being, you know, a mix of malt and molasses and any sugary adjunct you can find. It's hard to upsell, you know, even the entry level whiskey.
And now we've got the regularized poaching.
You know, where it's become a weird, you know, but there was never a natural transformation of rural poaching into a cottage industry, you know, which is what should have happened, you know.
Well, you know, again, these are the economic realities of life and legislation. Caroline, I see you nipping in here. Must be a few questions raised on the content of this chat.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely fascinating. I'm loath to stop the discussion. It's so interesting, Fionnán. Suffice to say, we'll all have to be buying the glass apart, and certainly the next instalment in your PhD research. The questions, I mean, lots of compliments coming in for you, and lots of people have read the book, Fionnán, so that's really really good. We had a couple of questions from Matthew, and probably more, I suppose, for yourself, Noel, around our own mash bills. I suppose with the expanding use of heritage grains in Irish distilling and emerging trends of deploying historical unique mash bills, do we have any intent on varying mash bills and experimenting with grains in the next while? I know we've certainly touched on and answered some of these questions in previous webinars, but perhaps you might have a comment on that.
I mean, certainly it bodes well for a lot of distilleries to have the choices to mix around the mash bills a little bit. We are fairly constrained with the technical file, that there's no doubt about that, but there is scope there. And we're going to touch on a few different styles in the next couple of years, absolutely. And, you know, for the last couple of years of distilling, we've kind of bedded down our pot still, we've bedded down our malt. Now let's try something with a little bit of rye, perhaps. We might do something else, you know. I mean, just watch this space is what I would say. And it's not going to happen overnight. These things take time. Definitely, I think. And it'll depend on a lot of what other people do as well, to some extent, as to what becomes more successful or better, or where the niches are, and to try and get into a bit of a market and say, well, look, there's a gap here, let's try for that one. You don't want to be giving away what you're doing at this early stage, because everybody else is going to jump on the bandwagon and then you're out of step. So look, everything's up for grabs, but keep.
And I think that actually answers his other question, which was, are we going to release our new make spirit at 3 years, or hold on to it for older expressions? So watch this space, Matthew, is all we can say. We've lots of exciting stuff coming down the line.
People ask that question, that there is a certain, there are reasons why you would and why you wouldn't. Sometimes you might find that the new make, a 3-year-old or 4-year-old, is quite palatable. And it does go in and out of balance, as I mentioned on the maturation side of things. As I say, if it's good enough, we will. But I guess my preference is let's hold as long as we can and see where we get that. And pull it in a sherry cask and give it another dimension, maybe that'll work. We'll see. Hopefully we won't take too long before. You know, we can have experimental bottlings. I think everybody wants to see and say, well, look, let's put out 1,000 bottles of it and charge an absolute fortune for it. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with that, but if there's a demand for that kind of thing, why shouldn't we?
It does help the marketing, though. Gives me something else to talk about. I have to say on that note, I think lots of comments around just fascinating conversation, Fionnán, and thank you so much for joining us this evening. I think we're only tipping the iceberg there, and we'll definitely have to have further chats, and we'll have to actually get you down to the distillery soon. We will be opening soon, and we'll have an announcement on that in the next few days. So want to thank everybody again for joining us. We have a loyal following, I think, every week now, and I see Eric there joining us from Belgium again. Robin, we've lots of our cast members, so thank you so much. We really appreciate all the support. And as usual, we will have the webinar on YouTube tomorrow or Saturday, and we're actually translating some of them to podcasts now, the ones that actually work well for that format. So next week we will be talking about our cask program in a little bit more detail with our colleague Kevin, as we promised a few weeks ago. So that's definitely one to tune in for. And tasting our 16-year-old, which is exclusive to the cask program, but a very, very nice dram.
And don't forget,
exactly. That's what I was just coming to, Noel. We actually wanted to just remind everybody that we do have some lovely hampers and special promotional pack for our trilogy pack, where we have a sample of our new fill spirit, or new make spirit rather, with our trilogy pack and our 200ml pack online at the moment. And they're all available for collection at our pop-up shop this weekend, which is in the foyer, and you can find out more details for that on our website. And we've lots of lovely hampers there as well. So make sure you treat your dad now after all the lockdown. I'm sure everybody will be wanting to treat their dad and see them. So lots to choose from there. So it only remains for me to say thank you again, Fionnán. Thank you, Noel, again, for a very insightful conversation and lots of grains of wisdom again this evening. And we hope you'll all be able to join us again next week for our webinar on CAS programmes and ours in particular. Good evening and good night, and thank you for joining us. Stay well.
Gotcha.